title was going to be something around spirituality, and after our last session, we realized that that there was still some stuff on the table, or under the table, perhaps is more appropriate, about sexuality. And the reason that I suppose we were hoping that we could open up some of these issues, because there are ways in which they really are related, and I'd like to lead off for a few minutes talking about hunches that I might have come up with or might have been thinking about this stuff, how there are parallels between prayer and sexual intimacy, or spirituality and sexuality, and what some of the parallels might be, and how we can learn from both of those human experiences, the experience of prayer being an experience of being really open to God, trying to be in deep communication with God. Prayer not being sort of what you learn in Sunday school, telling God what you need or asking God for particular things, but prayer as being a kind of listening, a kind of waiting on the Lord. Prayer as a kind of opening up your heart. Prayer also as struggle, as coming to terms with your own sadness, vulnerability, deepening your sense of joy and connection with the world. I don't know if many of you have experienced that level of prayer in your lives, that a time of opening your heart and opening your hands, opening your lives, and feeling God come present, or longing for God in a way that gives you a deeper insight into who you are and who God is. That, on the one hand, prayer. On the other hand, sexuality as something that opens you up to another person and opens you up to the world. Not sexuality as many of us have experienced it at different times in our lives, as simply kind of a nerve-wracking experience, or a frightened experience, or experience of trying to appease another person, or you know, please yourself, or somehow perform what's expected, or figure out what is actually going on. But sexuality as a kind of relaxing, as a kind of opening, sexuality as a discovery of a deep person, a deep longing within yourself, in a context of total trust, where you know that who you are sexually, and the longings that you have, and the desire as well as the fear that you have is in a context of safety, I suppose, that you really are safe, and that you don't have to be defensive, you don't have to clench your hands, you don't have to be afraid of the past coming back and doing a number on you again, but there's some confidence that comes into the relationship, or is present in the relationship, so that as you are more vulnerable with another person or with a friend. Sexuality doesn't need to simply be something that you do with a lover. It can be a touch. All of us are sexual all the time. There's no minute of the day when you aren't sexual. So though you may not be aware of it, there's some expression and that other people can pick up of your sexual being, because you can't not be a woman or a man. You either are one or the other, or some woman, man, a person that has deep longings and sexual potential, expressive potential. And these things, both prayer and sexuality, are things, places where we feel extremely vulnerable with other people, because and extremely vulnerable with God. We frequently feel that we aren't important enough to be loved by other people, and we aren't important enough to be loved by God. And that in and of itself makes both of these experiences difficult for us. Because I have a hunch about this, that maybe we haven't been loved very well. Maybe we don't know what it really means to be loved well. And so therefore, we have a hard time allowing that God could really love us deeply. We have a hard time allowing that Jesus, if we were to run into Jesus, that Jesus would be overjoyed to see us. We just don't think that. I don't think that Jesus would be overjoyed to see Jeff. I can sometimes think that, though. If I, in prayer, I can begin to understand that what God says is true, that I am deeply loved. The same is true in sexuality. I don't feel like another person could really want to hold me or want to be with me. What I think is that person wants a husband, or that person wants, you know, an interesting person to talk to, or that person is really afraid of being alone, or that person is sort of attracted to me because of one thing or another. But it's not that they really love me deeply, you know. And so, because I don't think, you know, I basically haven't been that well loved, and so. I'm not holding that up as an excuse. I'm just saying that's, and I'm not blaming anybody either. I think that my parents had a hard time, and it's hard to love people for themselves. And so frequently we arrive here not having been well loved, and so it's hard for us to imagine that we could actually be totally open in prayer and God would accept us and love us. It's very difficult for us to imagine that we could be totally open sexually with another person, and that person wouldn't be afraid of us or reject us or run away from us. And even that, you know, is not such a bad thing if we could be self-confident, because there's so many people that need to be converted. If I could love you intimately and selflessly, even if you were afraid of that, it would not turn me away, because I would know that your difficulty is great, that you haven't been well loved, and that you need some time to come to understand that my love is indeed genuine. But most of us are not that good at loving people, and so if someone doesn't love us back, or if we get some kind of mixed message or something like that, we're immediately a little defensive. Or we go into some shallow interaction where we both know how to play the parts. I do this, I buy you an ice cream cone, and you smile at me from across the room, and then, you know, I talk to you for 20 minutes, and then you ask me to go on a walk, and, you know, we sort of operate on and we may never get any deeper than the sort of just superficial meeting each other's superficial needs and never coming to the point of really being open to the other. And I'm not saying that we should be that with everyone, because clearly we could not be that open with everyone. That's why we have developed, I suppose, monogamy as a system of developing intimacy, and we've developed monotheism as a way of loving God, realizing that God is one, realizing that in our lover, all that we need to love and all that we need to be loved is present in that person. And to you know, promiscuity is so devastating because it reinforces all of the bad stuff that we feel about ourselves, that we aren't really worthwhile, that we aren't really that lovable. There are a couple of things in here. I don't know if they relate. A book called "Inviting the Mystic, Supporting the Prophet," which talk about faith in a way that ties into the experience of intimacy and openness and love as well. I'd like to just read through those, and then maybe we can open up the floor for discussion and see if other people have ideas about this topic. This is by Catherine Dykeman and Patrick Carroll. "Inviting the Mystic, Supporting the Prophet." By faith we mean not just mental assent to the content or propositions of faith, or one phenomenon among others, but the central phenomenon in one's life, assent to the central phenomenon of one's life. Better, a central relationship that gives meaning to one's life and allows one to perceive reality and to interpret one's experience in the light of that relationship. To have faith, or to faith, is to hand over the direction of one's journey to another, to yield up the illusion of control to someone who is essentially beyond our control, over whom we have no power. You can see how you could read that as both having faith in God and having faith in a lover, giving up control or the illusion of control to someone over whom we have no power. Because in intimacy, you don't have power over the other person, you share power. We have described faith primarily as a relationship. Any love relationship challenges us to greater honesty and transparency, to awareness of those areas of our lives where we hold back or refuse to face ourselves or let others see us as we are. To really love others means to become progressively more vulnerable to them, to risk letting them see us in the bad times as well as the good, trusting that they will still love us. This is essentially what we mean by conversion. Real conversion is centered on God. I'd add here, conversion, I think, if you're talking about love relationships, we have that term falling in love. And in the best sense, falling in love, we use that term because you really do sort of topple into it, you know. It's not something that you have control over. Real conversion, or falling in love, if you will, is centered on God or the lover. It results from a deeper turning toward God rather than a closer inspection of ourselves. Conversion at its root is not the action performed, but the source of that action. And the source of that action is the experience of being loved. So what he's saying is that you need to experience very deeply your being loved before you can either move toward God in faith, toward the intimacy of God, the intimacy of prayer, or move toward a lover in the faith that that lover, that your gift of love toward that person will be a good thing, can be accepted, and you won't be destroyed if the gift isn't accepted. I think that's all I have to read from that. And I think I've basically said my spiel. So, any reactions or responses? Maybe one way to approach it would be to ask a hard question, and maybe people won't be able to answer it because it is a little direct, but has there ever been a place where your sexual relationship with another, or your openness to intimacy with another, has been like a prayer for you, or has been sort of like a step stone to God, or you felt in a sense that God was present there as well? And conversely, has there ever been a time when your prayer has been opening up your heart to God, almost in a not sexual way perhaps, but in a way that is very deep, and maybe I don't know if, you know, there are mystics who talk about God in sexual ways. There's John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, where their sense of being in the presence of God is like being embraced by Christ or embraced by a lover, the sense of being cared for and touched by God. And I guess I'm asking that too. I suppose none of us have had any of those experiences, so everybody's going to sit here. But I know that, I'll just say that there have been times in my life when in prayer, in struggling with prayer, struggling with the silence of God. One time I remember being in a tent in Alaska in Denali National Park for like 3 days, camped next to a glacier, and I was trying to pray. You know, I had been a pastor for a year or so in Philadelphia, and I really need to get away from Philadelphia. Alaska was about as far away as I could get. Being next to a glacier was about as far into Alaska as I could get. And after about a day or two, I began to feel again the presence of certain struggles that I had sort of dismissed coming back to me because I created a space for them. And again, I was able to weep about a tragedy that I had in my life a couple of years before that, which I kind of put on hold because I work hard and I'm a responsible citizen and all of that. And I felt precisely that I was coming into a deeper sense of relationship with God, and that it was a kind of God touching me and holding me. And when I was being held by God, I could suddenly let go of some of the control in my life. It was a kind of wonderful experience to be all by myself, you know, 50 miles from the nearest road, just kind of crying and feeling God present to me.
Well, I think along that lines, I felt that way as far as praying to God when I had a job 10 years ago this summer, I think it was. Anyway, that I was in southern Missouri and west central Illinois, the Ozarks area. Anyway, I was all by myself the whole summer. So that was the first time that I'd ever experienced being by myself where I was the person that I relied upon to do my job all day, and I didn't have any other people, nor did I have a support of friends or whatever. The only support that I had was from God, and that was one summer where my faith really, really was deepened, and I know that reading the Bible helped, and certainly my prayer life was really, it got a lot stronger during that summer, because my only source of strength, as during that summer, was from God, and it, I seemed a lot more connected at that point in my life with God than I think at some other times, not all the time, but some other time. So yeah, I think being totally alone sometimes can help to strengthen your relationship with God.
Because of a need for intimacy.
Right.
Which gets articulated and do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? Or neither?
I think it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. I really do.
It's a toss up. I think a lot of people think that mystics and whatnot are kind of neurotic, that they should just sort of get it, sort of connect up with other people and But I do think there's some there is sexual energy in the mystical relationships that people, I mean, I think it's a question of keeping your heart open in a deeply longing kind of way, and it's not that it's not a kind of weird sexuality. It's just that energy, that longing energy, is expressed toward God, and it might be that. That you need a balance of expressing sexual energy in both ways.
I relate intimacy with God with seeing results in my prayer life. For example, today I was walking back. I went to go on a hike, but I got burned out halfway up the hike, so I came back. And it was really peaceful walking through the woods by myself. And I was just walking along, and all of a sudden in front of me there was this deer. And the deer stopped and looked at me, and I looked at it, and we stared at each other for a minute, and then it was kind of a neat experience. And then a little ways further, I sat down and just enjoyed the scenery for a few minutes, and I was praying and talking with the Lord. And after that I said, I wish that I would run into another deer so I can get a close-up picture of a deer. And so I walked along just about 5 feet, and sitting off on the side was a deer sitting on the side. And, to me that just really uplifted me, and, it made me feel closer to God.
Mm-hmm. I have to share this experience with Barbara. The other night I was walking up to the portal, and this lady that I didn't know hollered, "Oh, come quick, it's a miracle." And I said, Oh my God, I said, what's going to happen if the Blessed Virgin is appearing in a Lutheran retreat camp? This is really going to blow roll. It was a miracle. It was a little baby, a week old. Hmm. So well camouflaged that she could almost step on it. And it just brings out the harmony of God in nature and the plan. And if you have a plan, then you have a planner. My trouble with prayer is my concentration is about 1 minute. Well, two.
That's a lot of people's problem with sex, too. It is. It is, as a matter of fact, a lot of people's problem with intimate relationships is that they frankly cannot focus. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a problem. And people are asking me, well, what do you think about divorce? What do you think about divorce? And I think, well, people don't know how to love. People don't know. I mean, when I get close to another person sexually, I start to find that it's difficult to know what, it becomes extremely mysterious to me. It becomes extremely profound, and it's, you know, and so I think people just like freak out and get into just physicality, maybe, I don't know, I mean, but I'm trying to get people to talk about it. What's the deal? I mean, is there some connection here? What is, to you, what the good sexual relationships that you've had, are they places where something has been there that is that you can talk about, or is it just that you can't talk about it? It's, you don't have words for it.
My personal experience has been most of my adult life, I thought I needed to have another person to fully fulfill, to feel fulfilled, that I would be a whole, it took two people to make a whole person out of Paula. And after about the third significant relationship over 20, 25 years, you're starting to hear the same song, third verse, fourth verse, and looking and realizing that my fulfillment, I've been looking for other people to create my fulfillment. And realizing that no person can make that fulfillment. No, there's not. It's like people that there's never going to be enough money. There's never going to be enough love. There's not anything. There's a hole there that can't be filled. And finally going to God to get that hole filled, because nothing on this earth will fill that hole.
That's interesting. So if you follow that through, then prayer would be a little bit similar like that, that there's a longing within us for God, which we never really completely are acquitted of, or we never really get the answer to, and that sexuality is some of the same stuff. If sexuality is a longing for the deepest kind of communion with another person.
I think some of my closest maybe experiences with God as far as that type of relationship have come both right after a divorce and at the death of my husband. And the real close, it's nearly like a sexual experience in that there is sort of just a river, it's just like river of living water, something that just flows through you at that time, giving you a tremendous strength and a feeling of comfort, and of that you are not alone. And I have never experienced that except at those two times. I mean, this not that type of communion.
Would you call that mystical?
I wouldn't call it mystical.
No.
I just think it's the power of God that at that time, when you are so utterly helpless and you are so alone, that He just, and you don't really have to pray much. You can just say, Lord, I'm too tired tonight. Are you here? Where are you? And just sort of relax back. It's a relax. Oh, I just thought of it now. It's sort of a relaxation. And that's also important in a sexual experience. We get so tight with God. We say, you know, I want this now. This has to be this way. But when you're just absolutely helpless, and there you are, and you've gone through all these experiences, and there's God. And then I suppose, and then I never thought of it until now, but that could be also equated with the sexual experience of relaxing. mm-hmm. and letting God. Mm-hmm. You need to do that in other relationships too. Mm-hmm. Just a thought. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going
to speak to him. You said the whole thing, but I
didn't. Well, to me, the most significant relationships that I've had are ones where I've been able to we've been able to communicate on at least close to an equal level on our Christian faith, on our walk with Christ, and that to me is the glue that kind of held those together. I mean, at least that mm-hmm. you know, the most important part of it.
So for you, faith would be a kind of qualitatively different thing from intimacy with another person, that faith with God would hold things together, and intimacy with another person would be the thing that is sort of held together by faith in God.
By faith in God.
So there'd be a hierarchy there, that first comes a sense of faith in God, and then comes the ability to work within the relationship.
I've been thinking about the concept of how sexuality and spirituality are related for a few months, and I have to say that I have a hard time relating them sometimes, and I'm not sure. I wonder if it has something to do with the attitudes that we have about sex and how we sometimes try to hide it away or not talk about it. It's secretive, it's private, and it's all sometimes lustful and there's sometimes shame involved, or we think there should be, because there are all kinds of shoulds and should nots that society tells us about. And so for me to see God in my sexuality is sometimes a little hard, because I've been programmed the other way for so long. Mm-hmm.
Not so much of a mystical experience in the sexual moment for me, but there's been like the prayerfulness has come a lot in the form of, in the same way it would maybe out on the trail, and you look over a valley and go, ah, look at that. Or you get a rich smell of the new spring life from flowers and things comes to you, you go, oh, take a whiff of that, would you? Moments like that. And then the same as in the sexual experience is like, yeah, wow, thanks. A moment of real appreciation for one of the wonderful gifts of life. Maybe not so often, 3 meals a day, I don't know, eating maybe not so much, but it's so rare moments where you just say, thanks, this is me. Mm-hmm. And it is a spiritual gift. It's a natural gift, and I don't like people to separate the natural and the spiritual too much. I like them intertwined. I see that as a thing that God would smile to see us intertwine also in our perception.
Mm-hmm. But I think what Chris has said is true, and this is, it's almost as if there's this continuum, and I think it may come in our Judeo-Christianity from the Christianity part, that is the Greek part, which says that spirit is good and body is a problem. The flesh is weak, you know, and that idea has been conveyed through and has been picked up by a lot of the conservative religious movements, Calvinism and Puritanism in the United States, suggesting that somehow there's a proper place for sexuality, and it's with the lights turned off in the marital bed, you know, and any kind, even, you know, even in the 80s, there's still a sense that you have to fight through a lot of guilt or a lot of maybe you didn't have to. I don't know. Yeah. but I think they do belong. I would hope that we could find a way in which we could deepen the struggle or the issue so that our sexual experiences maybe deepen isn't the word, but transcend the guilt junk that people laid on us, that we don't get involved in, that we progressively free ourselves from relationships that are really destructive and actually, I mean, the kind of relationships that you should feel guilty about are destructive relationships, ones that really are harmful to you or to another person. But once you free yourself from that, then you have to also put the guilt on the shelf, it seems, and start to use relationships as a way of getting in touch with your own vulnerability. And that's a real important step. I think both in prayer and in sexuality, the growing to a place where you're not more and more, simply more and more comfortable, or both of you have learned roles. In the case of sexuality, the two persons have learned roles, or in the case of prayer, where you've figured out a little prayer discipline that you do all the time. But shouldn't these be places where you really are always kind of on the edge a little bit, opening yourself a little bit? I may have said this earlier this week, but therapy only works if you're doing counseling with someone. It only works if you're a little uncomfortable all the time, because you're not going to grow unless you're a little. I know a lot of people are in therapy and they're perfectly comfortable and they don't grow. They might as well, flush the money away. It's not helpful. You need to be a little uncomfortable, and maybe the same is true of in prayer and also true in sexuality, that you're always trying to open yourself up a little bit more. Uncomfortable may not be the right word. A little excited, a little taking risks. Maybe that's it.
I think those moments are really difficult to articulate, and I may not do a very good job, and may regret taking the risk, but I'm going to trust that other people have had them too. I think one moment I remember in my past when I felt them kind of merge was I had the experience of working with a person who was my boss, kind of the administrator, and also was kind of a spiritual mentor in that process. I mean, he knew a lot about spirituality and taught me a lot in that working relationship. But I was also profoundly aware of my own sexual energy whenever I was kind of in his presence, and felt sometimes that he was very much aware of that as well, and maybe even kind of playing on that, and was giving me kind of messages that were making me feel a bit uncomfortable, perhaps on the edge like you talked about, and not quite knowing what that was all meaning. And I was not raised to know that these things would happen to me, so to speak, and or that kind of thing would go on. And so finally I just kind of took the risk and acknowledged that energy there was there for me, and that I wanted to know what the heck these kind of messages were. And I wouldn't call it sexual harassment or anything like that, but I certainly felt like there was sort of some dynamic going on there. And it was one of those moments when two people got very, very honest with each other and acknowledged that was present between us. And also got us about the fact that neither one of us wanted any sort of physical consummation to any of that, but that there was a very deep kind of experience that went on between us, and kind of unexplainable, and yet we're going to kind of, I couldn't pretend anymore that it wasn't there, and couldn't acknowledge that it wasn't present. And it was sort of like a moment where I felt like I really loved very deeply this person for what I experienced in his presence and what I didn't need to fear or feel guilty about. And I can remember driving home from work after this very long conversation about the fact that he wasn't going to get any of his sexual needs met by me, that he had another place in his life where that happened. He was married. I was in a relationship. And yet, we sort of acknowledge this very deep sense of love. And I can remember driving home on the freeway with sort of tears rolling down my face, just feeling so deeply about this other person and not being afraid of it, and yet really joyful at the same time that could be there.
And I didn't have to act on any lust or biological drive, so to speak. It wasn't hormonal.
Well, it might have been hormonal, but it wasn't a consummated thing, and it was. And while you're talking about it, I can just feel the exhilaration of having gone through that, and that's kind of what happens when you take risks. Is that there's a possibility of great discovery or exhilaration.
Well, it freed us to kind of have a deeper kind of relationship that mm-hmm. wasn't being sort of paralyzed or stuck by mm-hmm. this other sort of unacknowledged.
The same thing can happen. I mean, I don't want to keep bouncing back and forth, but the same thing can happen when you finally confront God about some deep sense of anger or some deep sense of fear that's going on in your life about God. It sometimes takes a long time. I can remember another time when I went to a retreat center in France, L'Arche community, and just spent maybe a couple of hours a day praying. And gradually on, I started saying things to God about my life that I wasn't, you know, you just discover things. It's like in a relationship, you discover things about yourself in being present to God that you wouldn't discover if you weren't present, if you weren't going through the relationship. I mean, when you fall in love with somebody, you start to discover stuff about yourself.
Like it's sexuality, like when you first become a Christian, you know, some people call it a baby Christian, and it's kind of the same as falling in love. You're all excited, and you know, you want to share with everybody that excitement that you found in this special person. It's the same as when you become a Christian, you are all excited about Christ and you want to share with everyone your new love of Christ in your life. And I can see the similarities between a relationship with Christ as there is with a relationship with another person.
Yeah, and what I'm suggesting is that should never end. There should be a way in which your relationship with another person should always be deepening, and your relationship with God should always be deepening. But the only way that can happen is if you're not in control. Because if you're in control of it, you'll probably move it in a direction that you want it to go in, or stop it completely. Just probably why intimacy is such a mess in our culture, because there are so many people who try to control it, and won't allow what is possible to happen between two people happen. I mean, a lot of the feminist stuff that's been coming out has been sort of an outcry against male-dominated relationships and male-dominated society, everything, but it really has a profound effect on a relationship when one person is calling the shots and the other person is kind of responding. It isn't, in fact, intimacy. At least I have a higher definition, maybe.
I was just, the control in relationships between one person and the other, how do people work to gain more intimacy and not have one person have more control than the other?
Get rid of the marriage institution. I've had a relationship the last year that's been very much sounds a lot like Jackie's, where the man is married, yet we are very, he has shown me more love and taught me more about love through the friendship that we've shared. It was absolutely wonderful, and I feel deeply, deeply for this person. And I don't believe that it has to be consummated a love. We talk a lot about his marriage, and he says it's the best way to ruin a good relationship, and that he has to really work on it. He's got more integrity than anyone I've met, and he is more married as far as loyal and fidelity-wise to this woman that he's married to. But yet he has enough love to go elsewhere with others and for others. And I honestly don't know how I would have done as well as I did without him last winter. Just a really intense, and he taught me so much about love and got through me through a lot of the ideas about controlling expectations, relationship trips that you throw out that actually essentially work against the relationship. Mm-hmm. That if you can just say to someone that you are okay and I love you, and not have to really say it, but show it and know it, it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful. And I was able to try out a lot of my hurts on him because mm-hmm. he was married. I could trust it. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about sexual undertones.
That's a wonderful thing. I mean, we tried this last night. Was it last night? Where do we learn how to love? I think it's wonderful when you can come up against someone who has been through some relational stuff and can help you to learn that stuff. To go back to dealing with your question, I think a lot of young couples start out at a disadvantage because our culture doesn't teach that stuff a lot. And so issues of passivity, aggressivity, dominance, and issues of how to love, how to be proactive in love and not just waiting for it to happen. These things are things that you, it's hard to learn just with one other person and trying to sort of hunch it out. I've learned some of that stuff in counseling. I've learned some of that stuff in being counseled and in counseling others. In different relationships, each relationship I've been in, I suppose, has been a testing ground, and it's kind of an expensive way to learn intimacy, because there's a lot of blood on the ground afterwards. You know, there's a lot of hurt emotions and insecurity and sadness and things. But I don't know. I don't think as a culture we are very good at teaching how to love. You mean the developmental stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Developmental
stuff. So you would be saying that people just don't develop, that they sort of stop at a stage before they've developed a personality that's rich enough to actually negotiate love. Say that again?
Yes, that's the position I would take.
How many people have read any of that Erickson stuff? Do people know that book? Yeah. Do you know it well enough to talk about it?
Well, just that he feels that people pass through stages of development that include sort of tasks with each stage along the way, beginning with trust versus
mistrust.
Mistrust, I guess. And all of them kind of with one versus another. In other words, that you try to master a certain kind of issue and then you move on. I think there's about 8 stages, you know, all the way through. And if we sort of fail to kind of work through one task, we sort of get stuck there in many ways and keep kind of regressing. I mean, if we didn't, as an infant, learn that we could trust mother or, you know, caretaker to be there and to feed, that's kind of jeopardized throughout our lifetime, and we'll continue to struggle with that issue in ongoing relationships. Mm-hmm. Identity is another one that we have.
Yeah,
to
identity
kind of
versus confusion. Yeah, that's the adolescent. The one that you have to deal with in adolescence is identity versus confusion. So identity is, I'm an okay person. People like me. You know, I can get by in the world. Confusion is like, who am I? Where am I going? What am I going to do? And it's really quite radical. He figures that if you don't deal with identity versus confusion, you can't come to intimacy versus estrangement, or intimacy versus alonement, which is the task of young adults. Of early adulthood, and you either are able to be in relationships and able to rejoice in the lack of control that relationships bring, or you're in estrangement, which means that you cling to yourself and really are afraid to let go of yourself and enter into. I don't know. It's kind of a law, kind of an Old Testament view of relationships, that is, you know, kind of setting down steps or stages and saying this is where you get stuck. He may be right, though.
And the conclusion was wisdom. The wisdom was gained from experience, and which can be applied to people beyond oneself.
Any successful relationship between man and woman or man, God is going to involve openness and communication. Communication is a two-way street.
That's nice, yeah. So you mean, what do you mean, God has talked to?
Well,
listen, you gotta listen
right
to God.
I think it's all right to get mad at God.
Sure.
Say, you know, I've been going to church all these years and I'm still having all these problems, and what's going on here?
Isn't it interesting the way God sometimes calls us, seems to call us into deeper and deeper vulnerability? I mean, if you really listen to God's call for justice and for righteousness, God's call to be close. God really doesn't tell you how to do it. I mean, here we are at Holden. I mean, we're searching for some things. We don't know what's. Some of us are single. We're searching for some kind of some kind of deeper relationship. Some of us are working on staff, and we've really committed a great deal of time to this place. I think we need to start to glory in the vulnerability, to really kind of get off on how things are kind of gloriously out of control. What a glorious folly it is to come to Holden. What a bizarre idea, what bizarre idea possessed us to come here, you know? And I think the same thing could be true. I mean, as you hold someone in your arms and say, what a bizarre thing that I'm holding this person in my arms. What the, you know, what could I imagine I mean by this, you know? Or kneeling on your knees up in the woods on Chief Seattle Day to just glory in the rain that's falling upon you and say, what a folly it is that here I am in the middle of the woods searching for God, getting wet to the bone, and this is what it's meant to be. I mean, this is the adventure of life. I mean, if you're not gonna take the risks and talk about the stuff that hurts and talk about the places where you don't know what's going on, all you get in the end is a boring life. You couldn't even write a two-page autobiography about it if you don't take risks. I mean, it would just be like, well, you know, I did this for the first week, and that's what I did for the next 6,000 weeks, you know? And I took one risk when I was 18, you know, and it didn't work out, and that was it. Certainly Holden is a place where I've been impressed by the risks that people take. But it is a glorious folly. I mean, it's an adventure that few people understand. I mean, most people would walk into here and, I mean, they'd walk into this room and say, oh God, what are these people doing? Spirituality and sexuality, oh God, don't make me sit in on that one. Oh, shut up.
Baptism, get wet in life, come out bleeding and dripping wet. Aching, want more.
I think something that's really affected me since I've been at Holden these past few months, something that I just heard the other day, Elmer said in his sermon, how the church is going to change, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost thing to be
creator, lover, parent, or whatever. It's all up in the air, but using the word lover, and he said that God has such passion for us. It's like, it just like, felt like I'd been struck by lightning, because how many times in my life have I heard that God loves me, Jesus loves me, and all that, but it just never really hit me until I heard the phrase, God has such passion for me. Because I felt like I could understand passion in human relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Passion for, whether you have passion for music, or passion for a lover, or passion for best friend, or passion for mm-hmm. painting, or eating.
Yeah.
Just that when you just really feel that
really deep.
And that really, sort of, that's what I would really take with me. Mm-hmm. Of all of is that idea that God has passion for us. And, and I guess another thought that I've had too is that I have really grown to believe that my connection with people is a spiritual connection. When I'm really connected to somebody and really love them, and I've been able to be the loving but that is a spiritual connection, whether it's a sexual relationship or not. I think that's been in the last 5 years I've really learned that. It seems like I've been able to have deeper relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more painful too when you're saying bye. Even some of my friendships that I've made have been really painful.
Really painful, that's the thing. I can feel myself getting up for a really painful leaving of Holden. And it's kind of bizarre. I mean, I can just see that I don't feel like pulling back. I just feel like keeping loving people, and then the last day it'll be just like a complete blotto, you know? But I think that's one of the false images that we have about spirituality, is that spirituality is a way of cleaning up our lives. I don't think so, frankly. I think spirituality is a passion. I think it sort of messes things up. Just like sex is messy, I mean, in some ways, prayer is messy too. And I think one of the things that got me on this was us talking the other night, and after the last singles forum, we were talking, we got around to sexuality, and all of us agreed at one point in some fit of insecurity that once you kiss somebody, things start to get messy in a relationship, you know? Once you kiss somebody, it's like, and you better not. I mean, and we decided that you better not. I mean, once you can kind of hold hands and go on a walk, you know, and you can sort of. Barry was saying that if you sit across from a seemingly significant person two times at Holden Village, immediately the message has gone out that there's something going on. So a number of us became more circumspect about that at that point as well. But but this kissing business, you know, that it gets messy. And I was thinking, gosh, you know, that is right. Maybe what we should, you know, maybe we should just write up a list of the things that you shouldn't do in order not to have messy relationships. But, you know, just in a funny... No, sex is messy. Why is it messy? It's because we're not good at it. We need it so bad. We need to be loved, not sex, but we need intimacy so badly. And sexuality is an expression. If I touch Bob on the shoulder warmly, it is an expression of my sexuality. I mean, it's not a particularly, you know, a confrontative one, but it's my warmth, and I'm a sexual creature. The same is true of prayer. We don't learn how to pray in order to get our lives together. Because as soon as we start praying, we figure out that God is weeping up there for the poor and the lonely and the dying. God is up there passionate, not just about each one of us, but about a lot of people. And so we enter into the life of God, we enter into that mess. And it isn't particularly, it doesn't give us control over anything. It draws us more deeply into a place where we realize that God is God, and we are creatures, and we are what we can understand of God is just is God's call to be with God, you know, passionately. And so we get into a messy relationship, you know, with God.
And I guess I think that so many of my relationships are relationships with people. Are all little mini relationships with God.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Parts of them that are so mystical or godlike, or so sweet, whether it's a friendship mm-hmm. or a relationship or parent or whatever, that there's parts of God in them that's why they're so wonderful.
I think that God has a plan for each and everyone's life, and he places certain peoples together for his work to be, as a Christian, for him to work through you like a vessel, like we were saying in church on Sunday night. We are vessels for God to live through and shine through. I think most of my own personal experience of spirituality has been when I'm sharing about Christ or just sharing with someone, you know, I can see the intimacy and Christ go together, if you can follow what I'm trying to say.
The picture that I'm getting when you talk about passion and vulnerability and not taking total control, I'm just thinking of Jesus having so much passion for us that he became totally vulnerable and totally exposed on the cross and just gave up all control because of his love for us, and that's the ultimate kind mm-hmm. of love. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And if you could think of that almost the way that we fall in love, that's why I think there's so much to be mined here, there's so much to be discovered here. If you could think of Jesus sort of falling in love with the disciples, you know, just falling in love with them, just loving them so deeply and wanting to give them as much as he possibly could, and finding out that as he went along being loving toward them, he was running into these structures that were, and loving toward a lot of other people, he was running into these structures that were just dooming him. And yet he remained with love. He didn't become so fearful that he protected himself. That's hard to do. I mean, it's not something that I expect any of us to be able to do very, very readily, though there are people who do it. God sometimes gives us a particular grace to really be open to other people and really show love to them. I think it's a wonderful project that we can undertake, even in our personal lives, to try to find words that tie in to our most intimate experiencing. Like you just said something about sweet. Well, that's a word that's wonderful, you know. How did you use it? It's a sweet experience. I mean, that's what we say about our love, is she's really sweet. She was really sweet to me, you know. And can we say that about God? Or something that we'd say about God is that he gave up himself for me. Could we say that about a lover? She really gave up a lot for me. Could we use these languages interchangeably? And which is precisely, in fact, if you look at the Song of Songs in the Bible, is what happens. I mean, it's a love song, a passionate love song smack in the middle of the Bible. A lot of the Psalms are about that, too. Jeremiah says to God, you have loved me and seduced me. And I couldn't say no, you know. So there's a lot of that in there. I think that we as people who have a hard time loving need to try to tie together those few or many experiences of sweetness, of gentleness, of powerfulness, of justice, of righteousness, of hope, and apply them both to our relationships with others, to keep our hearts open to them, and also to apply them to our life in prayer to God.
Wouldn't you say that Jonah maybe had the same type of relationship, in the sense that, you know, he had that love with relationship with God, but he also had those quarrels, in a sense, mm-hmm. because you know, he was kind of running out on the whole relationship, and God brought him back. Then all of a sudden, he figured that God was going to just destroy Nineveh, and then he got mad because he didn't do it, and then he pouted about it.
Jonah wasn't terribly vulnerable, so I wouldn't put him up there. Jeremiah was really, really vulnerable. I mean, Jeremiah was the kind of guy who could weep. Jonah wasn't. So I don't mean to to say no, but I don't experience that about Jonah much. And what Elmer said the other night too about the whole thing might just be recapturing a feminine, I don't know how he said it, but a feminine aspect about the world. I think this, what we've been talking about tonight is a feminine way of looking at the world, that is, of being open, of being embracing, of creating, of not controlling particularly. That's something that we really as a culture don't, and as a religious system don't have. And you know, I'd say to both women and men here, that's something to think about in your intimate relationships. How can you be really open to other people, to your lovers? How can you stand firm in your openness, knowing that that's the way relationships are supposed to be, and not fall into some Tracy was asking about this, is how can you get away from the control dimension? I mean, to refuse, if your partner is trying to go into this control thing, there's a way in which you can refuse to do that and be successful at it. It would take more talking to get to that, but I believe that that's true. That you don't have to control a person back. It's sort of non-violent response in a relationship to someone's trying to take over the relationship.